here. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk to two researchers who gathered oral histories of Latina activists and community organizers from around Wisconsin. First, when you're confronted with some kind of math problem, do you get a little nervous? A lot of people do. In fact, some measures say more than 90% of Americans feel at least some degree of math anxiety. A study in 2012 showed that nearly a third of high school students said they felt helpless when doing math problems. So what gives, and how can we help our kids with numbers if we stress out about them too? It's a big question with lots of kids learning at home these days. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Do you feel uneasy with math? Where do you struggle the most, and how do you deal with it? Did it always come easy for you? Did you have to work at it? How do your kids do with math? Have you ever helped them out with their math homework? And have you turned around in math? Did it used to be a hard subject for you, and then you learned to love the numbers and shapes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Eugenia Chang is a mathematician, educator, concert pianist, and author. She's the scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago and the author of the new book, X Plus Y, A Mathematician's Manifesto for Rethinking Gender. Eugenia, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, these are questions you, I know, have been dealing with for years. Do you see some urgency out there about math with a lot more parents watching their kids in class at home and trying to deal with their homework in real time?
Yes, many things are urgent at the moment. And one is the situation we're in with education, where teachers are beside themselves trying to deliver effective education online, and parents are beside themselves trying to supervise their children. And meanwhile, the poor children still have the struggles that they've had for so long, unfortunately, surrounding math anxiety.
What is it, do you think, that leads so many of us to be anxious about math problems?
I think that it's in the way that math is presented as something with right and wrong answers. That's how it starts anyway. And in my book, X Plus Y, I talk about how math doesn't really have to be about right and wrong answers. But when we start showing that there are right and wrong answers, some children get put off and scared, and then they turn to subjects that don't have such obvious right and wrong answers, like writing and drawing and dancing and music. And the thing is that math is creative, like all of those subjects. And when we start in, say, kindergarten, just playing around with blocks, it's fun. It's just getting a feel for mathematical concepts. And then suddenly it turns into this thing where you can be wrong, and then you feel stupid. People make you feel stupid. You feel ashamed. You don't score as highly as other people. We rank children according to how well they do. And all of that serves to make some people very anxious around it. And I think understandably so.
I remember some stages of my math education in school involved, you know, double-sided pieces of paper with 20 problems on a side, each of which had a very right answer and lots of possible wrong answers. What is the other kind? What is a playful kind of math, not problem, I guess, but math experiment, math question look like for kids?
Well, the first thing I think it's important to say is that high-level math is much more like the playful math, and it's much less like just pages and pages of questions that you have to try and answer really fast. And the pages and pages of questions to answer really fast doesn't really model anything particularly in life that's useful. And so the first thing to acknowledge is it's kind of pointless for us to be doing that at all. And I think a much more interesting kind of math is where we explore structures and relationships between different situations and develop a way of thinking. The kind of math research I do involves really building things. I often say it's a lot like Lego. And there's some Lego where you have a particular kit and instructions, and there's kind of a right answer where you're supposed to build this particular whatever it is, Batmobile or something. But then there's the more expansive kind of playing with Legos, where you just get some bricks and build something, and there's nothing really wrong or right about it. And that is how I think math can be presented, that we explore mathematical ideas. And as long as we are wandering around some sort of mathematical universe, like we're playing with shapes, things like that, then we will learn how to think in mathematical ways. And I think that'll be much more productive than learning how to answer tons of problems and also be afraid at the same time.
I know a particular concern of yours is that there are particular groups of kids who then become adults who we don't look at as mathematicians, I guess. We don't count on them to do math. They're turned away from being interested in math. Girls of color in particular. Can you talk about that a little? Eugenia, do we still have you?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry, yes. Can you talk about...
I lost the connection for a second.
Oh, okay, good. I thought it was just me. So, can you talk about girls and girls of color in particular being turned away from math?
Yes, there are really big problems with inclusivity in mathematics. And one of the sources of that is the kinds of images we portray of successful mathematicians as kind of mad geniuses, usually white men, who maybe don't have great social skills and who have trouble making friends. And that's an exciting romantic tale that Hollywood movies can show. But then, unfortunately, it puts off anyone who isn't like that, in particular girls, people of color, apart from Asians, because, of course, there's the opposite stereotype around the idea that all Asians are good at math, which is another kind of silly stereotype. But the thing is that it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, because if we make it look like only certain kinds of people can become mathematicians, then the other people will feel like they can't, even though that's not true. And one thing I talk about in my book is that there is direct prejudice around gender. Some people still think that girls are worse than boys at math. But there's also indirect prejudice, where we make it look like to be good at math, you have to be very confident and competitive and fast, and you have to be able to memorize things and do times tables really fast. And none of those are actually important skills in higher level math. The skills that I think are important are being able to see connections between different things and being able to think deeply about something for a long time. That's kind of the opposite of doing things fast. And so we're actually putting off the wrong people, because the people who sit down and go, but wait, why is that true? Why is 2 + 2 = 4? Is there a reason behind it? Those are people who actually have potential to be really good mathematicians, as opposed to the people who go, this is easy, I'm really good at it. 2 + 2 is obviously 4, without even stopping to wonder why. And I think, unfortunately, we squash out those deep why questions, sometimes because they're just too difficult to answer. But I think if we can embrace questions that can't be answered, and if we can embrace the feeling that we don't understand things, then I think we'll actually be more inclusive of all the people who really do feel like they don't understand things.
We're talking to Eugenia Chang, mathematician and pianist and author. Her latest book is X Plus Y, A Mathematician's Manifesto for Rethinking Gender. We're talking about math anxiety, how to help kids overcome it, how to help grownups overcome it along the way. Let's go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. Carol is with us in Milton. Carol, hi.
Hi. I'm a retired elementary principal who loves mathematics and decided to try to get more expertise in how young children learn. And so many fascinating things, but the fact that the definition that mathematicians agree on is that math is the science of patterns. And trying to explain that to parents about, absolutely agree about the memorization. There's so much emphasis on memorization, and yet it's things like, if you're at 8, how far away are you from 10? Well, how about if you're at 28? How far away are you? How many more do you need to make 30? Using the base 10 and decades to help children figure out relationships in math. And very few facts have to be actually memorized. They can use those memorized facts and see relationships then for basic calculation, which, you know, isn't really all that important in the long haul. It's patterns and relationships. And, you know, we've taught math very poorly in this country for generations, and I'm still waiting for it to turn around.
Carol, thanks a lot for the call. Patterns and relationships, Eugenia, she says we should be thinking about more.
I completely agree. Thank you so much for that call. And I'm glad that you realized that as an elementary school teacher, because I think that one of the things that happens is that we do a lot of pattern spotting with kids at the beginning. And then somewhere along the way, it turns into that thing of memorizing facts and trying to answer questions a lot. And I don't blame teachers at all, because they're under all this awful pressure to get kids through standardized tests. And the standardized tests are not very interesting, and they tend to be about speed, and memorization really helps. And then the poor teachers get judged by the results of the students on the standardized test. And so this horrible vicious cycle happens where everyone is under pressure just to study to do the standardized tests. Whereas pattern spotting is a much more transferable skill, and it enables us to understand things in life that even don't seem necessarily mathematical, like patterns in the way that divisive arguments happen in politics, patterns in the way that logical flaws come up, in the way people try and justify faulty opinions. And all of those have mathematical thinking at their root, even though they don't involve numbers or shapes or things that people think of as math, like taxes and mortgages. And they're so much more transferable and important as skills than being able to do your times tables.
Carol, thanks for calling in. We're talking about math anxiety and a more fun, playful approach to math in many ways with mathematician Eugenia Chang. Her newest book is X Plus Y, A Mathematician's Manifesto for Rethinking Gender. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do numbers make you nervous? How come? Or did they? How did you get over it if you did? How do your kids do with math? Do you find it hard or easy to help them when needed? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. We're picking up our conversation about overcoming math anxiety with Eugenia Chang. She's a mathematician, educator, concert pianist, and author. Her latest book is X Plus Y, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your math anxiety questions, thoughts, maybe how you overcame it yourself. Let's go back to our callers. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, I'm glad I lived long enough to learn about the string theory, because it's all about energy. And I have a nephew who graduated from UW-Superior who gets excited about math problems, and a sister who teaches in Wausau, and she teaches her kids about, like, Schoolhouse Rock. You know, you learn the tables by singing a song. So it's all about energy and equating energy with the math problem to make the energy assist you in finding a solution.
Jeff, thanks a lot. I love the kind of conceptual thought about numbers, Eugenia.
Yeah, and I think that there are many different ways that people get excited about math. And one mistake that sometimes people make is say, oh, this is the way to get people excited about math. And the thing is to find many ways, because so many things get different people motivated in different ways. Some people are really excited by direct uses in life, like how you're going to build a bridge. And other people aren't interested in that at all, because they're not going to become an engineer and they're never going to build a bridge. And they're much more interested. Some of them are much more interested by questions of social justice. My art students at the School of the Art Institute, they're not going to be engineers or scientists or doctors. They are artists, and they really care about social and political questions. So for them, that's much more exciting. Math is a way of thinking, not math as a way of solving real life problems, because they're not interested in those kinds of numerical real life problems. So empathizing with everybody to figure out what motivates them in their life and tapping into that to show that math can be related to that, I think, is really important.
Jeff, thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Dana now in Wauwatosa. Dana, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Dana?
Well, I was listening to the portion of the show where she mentioned that there is some sort of discrimination. So my daughter is a senior at Madison. She's a mathematics major. She has a 3.5. She's a senior. And she has really experienced a lot of those kind of discriminatory behaviors towards her by professors and fellow students, because she's a, you know, blue-eyed, good-looking, you know, girl who actually loves math, and she doesn't fit the stereotype. And she tutors for the university, and she'll walk in, and a professor will say, "Can I help you?" She's like, "Actually, I'm here to tutor." And it's interesting about the musical aspect of the author, because, you know, in all my musical studies, to me, it was always about math. Music and math go hand in hand. So I think, you know, I just wanted to mention that. And I also think that I'm thrilled that she's a mathematics major, because right now the skies are the limits for people that can think analytically, and it just applies in so many areas of life. So anyway,
Dana,
I just wanted to comment on that.
Thanks a lot. You gave us a lot to work with there. First of all, unfortunately, Dana says her daughter experiencing at best mixed reactions, some discrimination, she says, even at the university level. Unfortunately, she's probably not the only one. Am I right, Eugenia?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, unfortunately. And I'm really sorry to hear that. But I'm glad you said it, because I want to address the question of imposter syndrome, because that is a big problem there, where people feel that they, even when they are achieving things, that they don't really belong there. And it's really important for us to acknowledge that imposter syndrome isn't something that we've invented in our heads. It, for many women and people of color, it's there because people have deliberately made us feel like we don't belong. And they have told us that we're stupid, or they've belittled us when we've tried to do things or made assumptions about us. And so imposter syndrome isn't really our syndrome. It's really a symptom of people around us having prejudices and being biased. And so we really need to make sure that we educate everybody to overcome those implicit or even explicit biases. So that's one thing I'd like to say. And another thing is the last thing that the caller said about how the sky's the limit. And I really think that's the case, that math opens up so many things. And for me, I have found that it is such a source of strength for me as a woman who does feel that people are trying to belittle me a lot of the time. I know that I can do mathematics and that I can understand anything if I put my mind to it. And that's such a great source of strength that I would love to be able to share with as many people as possible, male and female people, everyone who doesn't feel confident about themselves. Of course, there are some people who are overconfident about their abilities already, and that's a whole different prospect. But I think that while we try to teach, we spend too much time trying to teach proficiency, trying to teach people to be able to do math. And in the process, we don't pay enough attention to the anxiety that we're giving them. Because if we get them to be, if we train them to be able to do math, but they're anxious about it, then they will run away from it as fast as possible. And I think that as a baseline, we should first try and get people to appreciate and love math. The proficiency can come afterwards. If we don't base the proficiency on a love of math, then all that will happen is that they will run away from it. And then we get members of the adult population who are averse to math, averse to science, averse to reason. And then we get into a terrible, chaotic political situation.
Talking to Eugenia Cheng, mathematician, author of the book X Plus Y, Mathematician's Manifesto for Rethinking Gender, talking about math anxiety, how to overcome it and embrace the creative and even playful side of math. Ryan joins us now in Sparta. Ryan, hello.
Hello there. Thanks for taking my call. Say, when I was younger, man, when I graduated high school, I had no understanding of math. It was just horrible for me. But I'm a retired firefighter, and in order to become a firefighter, there's a lot of math involved. So I found a book. I don't remember the exact title, but it's something like Math for Dummies. And it taught me to, you know, generalize rather than exact numbers, take it apart and do approximate. And then that gets you in to the general area of the correct answer. Along with that, it just taught me how to break down like 12 plus 13. You put the 3 and the 2 together, you got the 5, and then you do the tens. So it was just a different approach than that memorization that you were talking about earlier.
Ryan, I love that story. Thank you so much. So he kind of went off on his own path and found a great way to learn to become, in this case, a firefighter, Eugenia.
Yeah, looking at relationships and patterns and the way that things fit together. I think that's what now in education gets called number sense, getting a feel for numbers rather than memorizing the outcomes. And I think that that is really important. And I think it's really interesting to hear that the caller was sounds like motivated by wanting to become a firefighter. And I think it's important to think about why we teach math at all. And we don't all agree about why math is important. Some people, of course, think it's not important. But there are, I think, reasons for teaching math. One is for the math that we actually need in our daily lives. And honestly, it's not that much. I mean, we need a little bit of arithmetic, but we all have calculators on our phone now, honestly. And maybe it would be good to be able to understand things like percentages and debt and tax and things. But then there's also the people who actually need math to go on to mathematical careers like engineering and science and medicine. But there's a third reason for teaching math, which I think is too often neglected. And that is that it's a discipline for thinking clearly. And gosh, wouldn't it be great if more of the world were able to think more clearly? That's what I think. And that every academic discipline is a framework for thinking more clearly. And math is one of them. And if we present it like that, then it suddenly becomes much more relevant to everyone, whether they are going to go into a scientific career or they're not going to go into a scientific career. Everybody, I think, wants to think more clearly. And I think that that approach to why we teach math gives us a whole different outlook on the kinds of math that we teach and the fact that it's not just about solving problems and getting a correct numerical answer, but it is about finding patterns, spotting similarities between different situations, and figuring out which information is relevant to a situation and which information isn't. And those are all such important skills for life.
In just our last minute, Eugenia, for that adult listening who thinks there's no hope for me on math, leave us with a bit of encouragement for them, please.
Remember the growth mentality, that there aren't math people and non-math people. Everybody can get better at it unless you label yourself as a non-math person, in which case you will make yourself a self-fulfilling prophecy and then you really won't be able to do it. So if you believe that you can get better, then it will become true. You can.
Eugenia, thanks so much for joining us again today.
Thank you very much.
Eugenia Chang is a mathematician, educator, concert pianist, and author. She's scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago and the author of books including X Plus Y, A Mathematician's Manifesto for Rethinking Gender. We talked to her about math anxiety and how to make our kids more comfortable dealing with numbers. Still time to share your math stories, happy, sad, hopeful, whatever, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know what you think and what your experiences have been. Coming up after the news, we'll meet the authors of a new book on Latina activists in Wisconsin and the growing role they've played in daily life and politics over the years, even the decades here in the state. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer Kent and her guests look back at tonight's scheduled presidential debate, and you can join in with your reactions. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, when we think of people who create change, we might think of an elected official or other well-known public figure. But a lot of times, change comes at the ground level, with an everyday person recognizing a problem in their community and working towards a remedy. Our next guest shares some of those community efforts in a new book that brings together the stories of 25 Latina activists here in Wisconsin. In the book, women around the state talk about how they became involved in community organizing or activism or public service, what they sought to change, and they talk about their sometimes complicated relationship to activism. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the history of Latina activism in the state? What role does it play in your community? If this is part of your life, love to hear your own story as well. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Andrea Teresa Arenas, or Tess, and Eloisa Gomez are the researchers and authors of the book Somos Latinas, Voices of Wisconsin Latina Activists. Tess, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having us. We're really excited.
And Eloisa, thanks for being here.
Oh, yeah, we're really excited about joining your show.
Well, Eloisa, can you talk about how this project got rolling?
Oh, you know what? I'm going to turn that part over to Tess.
Okay, go ahead, Tess.
Okay, I was speaking at the UW-Madison campus, my last job. I'm now retired. And a director from a National Oral History Project, Chicanas por mi Raza, was present, Linda Garcia Merchant. And she asked me if I'd be interested in interviewing one or two Latinas in the state of Wisconsin to add to their national collection of Chicana activists. And I very quickly, because I was at the time the director of the Office of Community-Based Research and Service Learning, said, I'll just build it in my courses and let's look at more than one or two Latina activists. And as a result, from 2012 to 2015, we're still doing interviews now, we created the Somos Latina Digital History Collection at the Wisconsin Historical Society, where my students produced documentaries on 43 Latina activists over the age of 50.
So there's a lot of material there. Eloisa, can you tell us what ended up in this book of collected stories from many of the women you talked to?
Right. It was just impossible to do justice and provide summaries of the experiences of the 43 women. So we took a subset of that and we worked with the experiences of 25 women. And I want to just stress, with Tessa's initial work and with the student support and that of the Wisconsin Historical Society and others, it was really important to make sure that we captured the stories of our women before they passed on, so that the emphasis was on our older Latina. So that kind of covers that period of like the 1960s through the 1990s for the most part. And from just, wanting to hear about their stories, it was very clear we needed to really understand even their childhood to see how the experiences that they were involved in as adults in particular was influenced by earlier years. So we kind of covered a range of areas and started off with their childhood. And then we were exploring some themes. Should I talk about the themes?
Yeah, well, one theme I wanted to bring up, Eloise, if you want to start with this one, is what motivated these women, you write about this in the book, to get involved in one way or another. And it doesn't seem like they did it because they wanted to be rock stars and be recognized. What did motivate them?
Right. No, it was definitely, in fact, the comment we heard the most was, why me? What have I done that would merit this kind of attention? And that really struck a chord with Tess and I, because, it just really really showed that they were women of very humble experiences and felt that what they were doing were just what had to be done. In fact, that's often how we would quote them. This is what we felt needed to happen in our community, in our neighborhoods, inequities that they were witnessing as adults. But what motivated them, I would say, is the witnessing of injustice, such as racism towards their families or their communities early in their lives. I'd say that's one half of it. And the other half would be witnessing acts of tremendous generosity, helping people when you didn't necessarily have to go the extra mile to help someone. They witnessed some of their family members, an aunt, a father, a mother, doing something extra special for people. And I think those two sides came together in their lives at some point. And when they were kind of called to respond to, or felt that they needed to respond to injustice that they saw, they took it on.
Tess, another interesting thing I noticed with the book, and again, you talk about this in the book, is the wide range of things that that can be called activism, that the women you write about, whose stories you share, it could be showing up at protests, it could be going to city meetings, it could be joining a chamber of commerce or a police department. So you cover a lot of ground with the different kinds of involvement.
Yeah, we didn't use a common definition of community activism. We had the women describe to us what they felt was community activism. And so many of them said it wasn't marching in the streets, although all of them have done that and some of them continue to do that. But we really wanted to shine a light on the fact that community change is in a variety of formats and uses a variety of strategies. And it can be the behind the scenes paper shuffling and duplicating and the like. And it can be on the front lines at a city council meeting, testifying, or at a rally. But we really wanted to show that there's no one way to be engaged in your community, and all of it is valid and all of it is helpful.
We're talking to Tess Arenas and Eloisa Gomez. They are the researchers and authors behind the book Somos Latinas, Voices of Wisconsin Latina Activists. And Eloisa, I want to talk a little more about why you are sharing these stories. I think people might think of Latina and Latino community in Wisconsin as, you know, a new thing, 1990s maybe and beyond. And these stories go back way before that. And that's an important part of, I think, why you did this project, right?
Right. You know, Gloria Steinem once said, women have always been an equal part of the past. We just haven't been a part of history. And I feel we've been, the work of our women has really been neglected. And so being able to uplift their voice with them, using their own voices to explain their experiences, I think brings a dimension to what community building is all about that we did not understand. And I think we still have a ways to understand. So one of the concepts I think that does exist, but really hasn't been fully explored, has been this whole notion of community-focused collaboration building. How do you take on a project in your community when you really don't know necessarily fully the issue, who to work with to create the change to make it happen? And then you move forward and say, okay, I don't know, but I'm going to give it a try. And that's all part of, I think, dimensions that I think we need to better understand and embrace, because I think that this offers some real tools for us in current times.
I want to start to meet at least a couple of the women you write about. We won't have time to get to all 25, of course. Let's start with Maria Luisa Morales, who's been advocating for, well, on a number of issues, including awareness of farm labor and voting rights. Tess, could you share some of her story?
Oh, Maria is an absolute wonder. She is one of those on the more engaged side, shall we say, in the sense that she has been in the streets and led marches and protests. And there are so many stories. One of them was when she was in a protest for, I believe it was immigration, and people were there, as many Latinos do, we bring our families, our children. And so it was a mixed generational crowd at the protest. And she looked up, and there along a ridge were SWAT teams. And the crowd got very nervous and uncomfortable, and people started to go to their knees and hold up their children as if to say, you know, please don't hurt us. We have our kids with us. And Maria said to herself, I can't kneel. I'll walk away, but I can't kneel. And this is just one of the stories where she stood face to face with some very difficult and sometimes potentially violent situations, and just kept her head about her and continued to do her work.
You know, another example regarding Maria was she attended one of the common council meetings in Racine. And, you know, this was something very foreign to her. And it is to a lot of people, you know, to go to City Hall and to bring up an issue of street improvements for a community, or concerned about employment discrimination. And when she went, she really didn't feel necessarily she had a voice or that she would be listened to. In fact, that first effort, they weren't listening to her. And so you just watch this evolution over time of people taking that first step, and it's scary. And sometimes, you know, you just back off and say, gosh, this isn't for me. I don't have these skills to make change. And she kept at it. And eventually, you know, she became more confident in challenging systems that were not just.
We're talking to Tess Arenas and Eloisa Gomez. They're the researchers and authors of the book Somos Latinas, Voices of Wisconsin Latina Activists, which provides interviews and histories of Latina activists here in the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question for our guests or a story to share. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now about the book Somos Latinas, Voices of Wisconsin Latina Activists, with authors Tess Arenas and Eloisa Gomez. Let's look at another one of the people you profile in the book. Eloisa, can you tell us about the story of Carmen de la Paz, an educator in the Waukesha area?
Oh, boy. Thank you. And she's another wonderful example of a woman who is sort of pulled into community involvement. She had just come from Puerto Rico with her husband, and they moved to Waukesha, where he found employment. I believe his uncle lived there. And so they landed in Waukesha and really felt it was inhospitable in many ways. Neighbors refused to talk to them because they were Latinos. And so that was challenging for her and her growing family. And at one point, there was a woman from her neighborhood who said, I'm going to a rally in Milwaukee. There's this priest named Father Grappi who is leading a march to challenge housing discrimination against Black people. And Carmen went, and it was one of her first exposures to the organizing effort of community to create change. And she began to be further pulled into needed changes in Waukesha. For example, there was limited services available to non-English speaking Latino students. So she and her two children eventually went to the Waukesha public school system, and they began to try to work collaboratively with the school system to say, hey, you know, more services are needed. And some of the services that exist for everyone are dispersed unequally among Latino and non-Latino students. So she began to be further pulled into that. And I want to highlight one feature of this, which is what is another important feature, is that her husband had difficulty initially with her role into community organizing. And at one point really kind of challenged what her role should be, and really more emphasizing her role within the family, the more of the traditional Latina model of homemaker and family support. But she began to challenge that in a way that eventually brought him around to supporting her, and he became an active community member as a result. So it just really, you see this evolution and you say, yay, you know, right on, Carmen, you're doing all these wonderful things. But these are steps that evolve over time, and some of them are very risky. She at one point came to a crossroads as whether or not her marriage or community involvement. And all the women at some point reached one or more crossroads in their lives as they became involved in their communities.
And Tess, that story of Carmen is another theme. I think of many of the women you profile were involved in one way or another with advocacy when it comes to education. Can you talk about that theme that connects a lot of the women?
Right. So much of their standpoint, so many of their standpoint moments, meaning when they became active, were the result of educational inequities. And as Eloisa said earlier, their standpoint moments started close to them. It was something that happened to their children or something that happened to a relative that they either observed one-on-one or heard of and said, I can't let this go by anymore. And education was an area that for many of our women, their first entree into activism. It could have been discrimination in a classroom. I believe it was Gabriela Gamboa in Green Bay, who is a native of Mexico. Her children were put in a particular class, and Gabriela was uncomfortable with that because she felt it was based on their language abilities as Spanish speakers and not their academic abilities. And Gabriela got involved. And she is from a quiet town, and her parents had a small business, and this was not something she was groomed to become, but because of her children and the educational system, she got involved. Carmen de la Paz in Waukesha had an incident with her son, who is Prieto, dark, and it was picked on the playground at a Waukesha public school, and someone ripped his jacket, and Carmen said, oh no, that's enough, gotta go in, gotta fix this. And so education was often an entry point for their activism, and others just saw that education as it was manifested in their community wasn't fulfilling the goals they had for their children, and started their own schools like Rita Tenorio with Escuela Fratni in Milwaukee, or Deborah Gil Casado in Madison starting Nuestro Mundo's Immersion School. So education has been a entry point and has had tremendous changes as a result of these women.
Eloisa, you mentioned earlier that part of what got women into activism in some cases was a role model, seeing someone else who had taken action. Do you see the women you profile in the book becoming role models for another generation of local activists, local leaders?
You know, they certainly have been inspiring to the younger generations. You know, I think neither Tess nor I really had a sense of how the book would be accepted by the younger generation. We thought that they would embrace it, and it really wasn't until we took the book on the road, if you will, met with many college-age students. We've been to a variety of higher ed institutions and to other places in which our younger women are just so excited to say, you know, this is part of my history, and I didn't know that. And it also, I think, calls into mind that the labeling of community activism is somewhat stereotyped. And when they learn about the roles of the women, they say, hey, you know, I actually know some other women who would fit that concept of a community activist. You know, it could be my neighbor down the street. It could be my aunt. Maybe it was my grandmother who was it. And so I think we've expanded, I think, what the notion is of community activism, and by broadening it, I think people feel like they can embrace that concept to even include themselves.
We'll leave it there. Eloisa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, well, thank you so much for this opportunity, Rob.
And Tess, thanks for being with us. We're talking to Andrea Teresa Arenas and Eloisa Gomez, are the researchers and authors of the book Somos Latinas, Voices of Wisconsin Latina Activists. They joined us to share some of the stories from their book. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll look back at last night's presidential candidate debate, the last in the campaign, and you could join the show with your reactions. Also, Confederate memorials have been a big part of the political landscape this year. An author looks at the origins of those memorials and what they mean today. COVID-19 has had a lot of real-world consequences, but it's also been the subject of a lot of misinformation, disinformation, and conspiracy theories. A new WIS Context report looks at the spread of bad info about the disease. All that, plus Food Friday. It's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Tomorrow's Food Friday conversation will focus, as usual, on good cooking, in this case, oven-roasted seasonal vegetables. Looking forward to that. But back on Monday, we invited you to share your stories of cooking gone wrong. It's the conversation that keeps on giving. I have still more of your stories to share from the Ideas Network Facebook page. Richard tells us, I took out a pan of lasagna in a Pyrex baking dish, set it on my stovetop, and the pan exploded, sending glass and red sauce, melted cheese everywhere. I contacted the company, and they sent me a new one, and then chain store pizza. Something like that happened to me once, actually. I made a big batch of soup, just ate a little bit of it to try it, went to put it away after it cooled off, got in the big glass container, couldn't get the lid on, pushed too hard, popped out the side of the glass, ruined the whole batch of soup. Nicole says, I was making Thanksgiving dinner for the whole family for the first time in our new home. I was almost finished. I pulled down a saucepan and poured in the can of gravy when I noticed something floating in the pan. A mouse dropping. Thank goodness my mom was there to help make gravy from the turkey juices. Nicole says, even if she hadn't been there, I would have called her. She's my cooking expert. And Brandy says, I accidentally left the crust cooking too long in the oven for lemon bars. Yum. I thought I could make up for it by turning broil on. After all, it would heat up the top, the filling part faster, and it would even out then, right? Wrong. Thanks for all of you over the week sharing your bad cooking stories. Keep them coming on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.